99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to continue on what's going on and some of the global trends in the economy, particularly central banks and their recent drift towards raising interest rates and selling off their balance sheets. What does this all mean? Some developments here this past week. We released the minutes of the Federal Reserve Bank and intense debate going on within the Fed on how soon to sell off their balance sheet and raise rates further or not. Important signals coming from the European Central Bank with that same intent. Even the Bank of Japan discussions going on. So we've got a shift in progress here, both with regard to raising interest rates, Federal Reserve, central banks raising interest rates, and selling off the balance sheets. What's the balance sheet? Balance sheet is the result of the central banks buying up all these assets from the private sector. Some of these assets are government bonds, and some of them are agency bonds, mortgage bonds. But in Europe and Japan, it's not just government bonds. It's corporate bonds, buying up corporate bonds, buying up stocks, buying up other securities in Japan and so forth. And as I said last week, it's probably around $15 trillion, I would say, of purchases by central banks of all of these assets. So we're looking at $15 trillion in purchases by central banks. That's a lot of money. Well, officially, the U.S. Indication is $4.5 trillion. In other words, the central bank, the Fed, has purchased $4.5 trillion. But as I said last week, that's not totally accurate, because what you have is, since 2013 and the U.S. QE quantitative easing program formally ceased, there still is bond buying going on by the central bank, the Fed, as the previous bonds mature and roll off the Fed balance sheet, they use that money to reinvest. So in terms of accumulative QE, it's probably, I've seen estimates of about $7.7 trillion. And then you got the Bank of Japan, which has been buying 80 trillion yen per month. That's somewhere around $70 billion since 2013. So we got close to $4 trillion, you know, $800 billion a year or more in purchases going on in Japan. We've got the Bank of England now in its, since Brexit, purchasing again QE bonds and so forth. And European Central Bank buying $68 billion a year in corporate and private and government bonds of various sorts. And we don't know what the cumulative roll-off effects have been with the BOJ and the BOE and ECB programs. You know, assume roughly the same 20% maybe repurchases going on. So it's close to $15 trillion. Now, what does that $15 trillion represent? Well, it represents massive subsidization of the private banking system. That's what it represents. See, in 2008, something changed in the global capitalist system. Something fundamentally changed. And that is, the system could not get going again at previous real growth rates. And investors had lost massive trillions of dollars as their financial assets collapsed. The central banks stepped in and accelerated their provisioning of liquidity, in other words, money supply, to the private banking system, and not only that, but private investors now as well, and shadow banks and so forth. What's changed is that the central banks, led by the Fed, but all of them in the major advanced economies, are subsidizing the system like never before with money, free money, printed money, electronically printed, but printed money nonetheless. This is really significant. This is new. Can't emphasize it enough that something qualitatively has changed since 2008-09 in the last crisis. The system cannot survive, it appears, without this massive injection of liquidity and money by the central banks. You know, they talk about the functions of central banking. What are some of the main functions of central banking? Well, providing loans to the government, that's always been a function. In fact, that was the first function of central banks a couple hundred years ago. A private bank arose amidst the other private banks to play the role of raising funds for the government, for the state, by aggregating loans and raising money from amongst other banks and wealthy and so forth to fund the state, to fund its expansion, particularly military expansion, as all these European countries, which is where this originated, central banking, a couple hundred years ago, as you know, they began gearing up for their conquest of colonies and the maintenance of imperial rule and so forth. You needed big military to do that, and for their wars and so forth. The banks, a bank, played that key role of raising funds. The early central banks were also private banks. They competed in the private banking system market just as they played the role of a bank of the banks, raising money among the other banks for the government. That was the first function. In the 19th century, that function migrated to another new function, and that was currency. To get control of the currency. As global capitalism migrated out of gold and silver as the currency to paper currency, it became easy for any bank to create paper. Well, that caused chaos. So the governments pushed for, let's centralize the currency creation under one bank. And that, of course, would be that preferential bank that was raising all the money for the government. You see, this control monopoly of currency only begins in 1844 with the Bank of England. The U.S. does not get control over its many, many currencies out there until 1913 with the Federal Reserve. It makes a futile attempt in the 1860s with the national banking system, but it's, you had thousands of currencies, thousands of different kinds of dollars being issued in the 19th century in the United States, paper dollars. You know, there's like the dollar of the Bank of Savannah and a dollar of, you know, the Bank of St. Louis and so forth, and it was chaos. So as the capitalist system evolved and gold and silver was not sufficient to finance the production and exchange of goods and services because the economies were getting too big, they had to create currency, and then they didn't get control of the currency until mid-19th century at the earliest. You see, central banks are really a phenomenon of the modern period. They grow out of the private capitalist banking system and evolve along with it. and start adding these functions. First function, raising money for the government. You know, next function, attempting to get control of the currency, the paper currency, which they did. And then as the economies got bigger and more complex, they kept having, the private banking system kept having these periodic crashes, you know, every 5-6 years. And sometimes these crashes were, financial crashes were so severe, they dragged down the rest of the economy, caused depressions. The 19th century is a history of depressions in the U.S. And England and so forth, you know, every 5-6 years. And these depressions lasted for, 6-7 years sometimes. All right? So the central banks began assuming some role of banking supervision, but not very effectively. And every time there was a crash, they had to bail out these private banks because they never regulated them very well. So you took on this what's called lender of last resort function by the central banks. Lender of last resort, what does that mean? That means I'm going to bail out the private banks. I'm going to lend them the money and bail them out. That's all that means. So we see evolution over time of central banks adding on functions as the private banking, capitalist banking system began to evolve and get more complex and more unstable. Central banks are a creation of the capitalist banking system. Now, where we are here at the end of the 20th century, early 21st century, is that the private banking system has gotten even more complex than ever before. It's gone global. Technology has played a role, accelerating money supply, money demand, credit, and so forth. And the capitalist banking system started developing shadow banks and all these liquid financial markets and all these financial engineering new products and so forth became even more complex. But the central banks have not been able to evolve to be effective bank supervisory institutions. Politically, they're held at bay anyway. The central banks have always been influence dominated at times by the private banking system, and it still is even more so today. And, of course, we see how the banking system, finance capital, has deepened its influence and control over the government itself. You know, who's running the economy in this country right now? It's Goldman Sachs. They're in all the key positions in government from Treasury on down. Who's running foreign policy? The generals. That's the Trump administration. He sits up there, tweets. He's not running. He's not acting like a president. He's got nothing to do. You know, he's a figurehead. You know, he upsets the apple cart now and then, and so forth. But he's not running the show day to day. Foreign policy is run by the generals and the spooks and the CIA, NSA, so forth. And the economy is run by Goldman Sachs. So the banks have deepened their influence within the government itself, and they have evolved certain ways of dominating the central bank, the Federal Reserve, which I outlined in my book, by the way, how the banks are really running the Federal Reserve. Okay, so you got this situation where the capitalist banking system is evolving so fast, the central banks, who are supposed to play a kind of a stabilizing role, you know, with supervision and lender of last resort when they get out of hand and so forth, are failing. Failing because of political interference from the banks, and also failing because their structure and their function today can't keep up, has not kept up with the restructuring and the change in the private global capitalist banking system. So they're failing. In the book, my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression, which comes out next week, is really about that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that shortly here. But the main point I'm making here is that the central bank, the Fed, in the case of the U.S., is behind the curve. And its lender of last resort function has really failed in the long run. Lender of last resort is supposed to be bailing out the banks and be stabilizing the banks so you don't have another crisis. Well, they bail out the banks, but they don't do it in such a way that it stabilizes the banking system. And you get another crisis, you see. The history here since the late 1980s is an increasing number of financial crises and a growing magnitude and geographic scope and market scope of these crises. That's the history. Well, it shows that the Federal Reserve, which is responsible for supervising, has failed. And therefore, it has to engage in lender of last resort bailing out more frequently at greater cost the private banking system. That's the reality. And the last crash, 2008-09, was so serious that the lender of last resort bailout function, I believe, has transformed into a totally new function of the central bank, which is constant subsidization of the private capitalist banking system. And that's performed by this massive liquidity pumping constantly $15 trillion through QE alone, not even talking about other traditional forms. QE alone, traditional forms of money supply regulation by the Fed central banks. So, you know, could be $20, $25 trillion globally in just 8-9 years, just to keep the system afloat. How fragile is the banking system? Well, there's probably at least $10 trillion of non-performing bank loans out there. You hear about the tip of the iceberg, you know, in Italy and Europe. But Japan's got the problem, and China's got even a bigger problem. There's at least $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans. In other words, loans that banks have given to non-banks and other banks, and they're not being paid back, right? Sitting on balance sheets, you see. So there's $15 trillion formally on the balance sheets of the central banks, just the major central banks, you know, four or five major ones we're talking about, right, is a reflection of the massive unpaid debt that was on corporate private balance sheets that's been transferred to the central bank's balance sheets. You see, they never really resolved the problem. They just moved the debt from the private sector to the government sector. Central banks being the government sector. Also, deficits in debt, the federal government debt represents some of this transfer of the debt from private capitalist corporate interest onto the balance sheets of the governments and onto the balance sheets of the central banks. Nothing's been resolved. They're just moving the money around, moving the debt around is what is the same thing. Okay, now the central banks are saying, what are we going to do with all this debt on our balance sheets, you know? If we have another recession and crisis, which will happen because, you know, the end of history is not here, how are we going to add even more to it? Well, we got to see if we can get some of this off of our balance sheets somehow to prepare for the next recession, because it's been, what, almost 9 years since the recession? In the U.S., average is 7 years. All kinds of signals, indications that the economy is weakening. I'll talk about that some. And it's been the weakest, most anemic recovery for the real economy. In other words, not the financial side, but the real economy in U.S. history in over a century. So we're going into a ninth year, the weakest recovery, and a highly fragile banking system, and people's real incomes, for most, having stagnated terribly or declined, while the incomes of a very small sliver have accelerated and escalated. Not a good situation to go into another recession or a financial crisis and crash. So the central banks, like the Fed, are saying, well, we got to prepare for this. You know, we got to sell off or somehow get rid of some of this on our balance sheet, clean it up, so that we can prepare for the next one. Now, the minutes of the latest Fed said in publicly, Janet Yellen has indicated, the chair of the Fed, that they're thinking of selling off some of the balance sheet. Very, very, very slowly, you see. $5 billion. Well, look, they got a $4.5 trillion. $4.5 trillion, they're going to sell off $5 billion a month, maybe. Well, that's pretty token. However, it may raise interest rates even more, you see. And the question is, how high can U.S. rates rise before it precipitates a financial asset price pullback of major dimensions and slows the real economy? That's fragile. Both are fragile, you see. Stock prices, markets, and so forth have, in bubble territory. And investors, when they're in the bubble territory and they've reaped all these huge profits and everything from speculation and financial assets, stocks and bonds and so forth, they're just looking for an excuse to take their money and run. And that excuse is rising rates, you see. At what point will the rising rates, how high do the rates need to go before investors say, oh, time to turn around, take our money and run, which will mean a collapse of stock prices. A major, major correction, right? That collapse is going to be more serious than in the past because changes have occurred in financial asset markets that make it more fragile. Okay, what do I mean? Well, if you look at stocks, U.S. stock market, the Dow, the NASDAQ, S&P 500, what you see is more and more institutional buying by professional investors. And the rest, what we call retail investors, have put their money more and more into these fixed kinds of stock buying security markets like exchange-traded funds, right, or index funds. Rather than trying to figure out how the market's going to go, all the money is for retail investors plowing into these ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and index funds, so that when the correction occurs by the professional investors, who are 80% of the market now, right, all those folks that put their money in the ETFs and index funds aren't going to be able to get it out. And it's going to collapse faster than it did in the past. Okay. That's part of the growing fragility of the financial system. So the Fed says it started raising interest rates here, you know, in the last 6 months, 1.25, you know, the benchmark federal funds rate. I don't believe it's going to raise that rate much more. But it's going to start selling off its balance sheet, and that's going to have a psychological effect of raising rates. The question is, right, what is this going to do to the bond and stock markets? Well, bond prices are already falling because of this expectation, right, of sell-off of the balance sheet and raising of rates by the central banks. In the show last week, we talked about, is there an emerging bond market rout in progress here? In other words, sell off of bonds. Right? Bond prices move in inverse relationship to bond interest rates. Well, as rates are raised, the prices of the bonds collapse or decline and then collapse. Investors don't want to hold bonds as assets if the value of those assets, the price of that asset, begins to decline. They want to dump them. They want to sell them. Well, that creates more supply and drops the price even more. So is there a bond rout going on? You know, are we going to see as the central banks, the Fed, ECB and others signal they're going to continue raising rates and may accelerate the rate hikes by selling off their balance sheets. Are they going to do that? How far can bond prices drift down below before they start to accelerate? And that becomes a bond rout. Well, the bond sell-off is continuing. You know, we talked about, is there a bond rout brewing? Brewing. It's not here yet. And the sell-off has continued here in the past week since our last show. As the Fed has indicated in its minutes, it's going to sell off its balance sheet. And as the European Central Bank has indicated in its minutes, that it's seriously considering doing the same. Especially in Europe, German bond prices, benchmark German bond prices have fallen significantly and rates have risen, right? At what point, do the bond decline prices become an accelerating bond rout, and what signal does that give to the rest of the financial markets? Now, it's interesting to note that the Federal Reserve has always said its target is 2% inflation for goods and services, right? That they're going to continue pumping money into the economy through QE as long as necessary in order to stimulate the real economy to raise prices to a 2% level. Now, it's interesting that the Fed last 6 months has continued raising rates, which slows the real economy and prevents the attainment of the 2% price level. Despite that, the Fed is raising rates. In other words, there's a big mismatch between the Fed's own objectives of 2% price level and the fact that it's raising rates and selling off its balance sheet soon, that will raise rates even more. Well, what does that mean? You know, is this been all a farce, the 2% price level, which has been in effect for 5 years now, and the Fed has never attained 2% in 5 years? So why has it continued talking about a 2% inflation level that it's never attained? I think it's phony. I mean, the Fed core inflation rate is like 1.4, 1 to 1.4, and it's raising rates. It can't hit the 2%, and it's raising rates, which is going to make it even harder to hit the 2%. Well, the Fed has also said in the past, well, you know, we want to get wages up. Well, wages aren't up, you know, unless you throw in the salaries and the bonuses and all the other things that counted as wages of professionals and so forth, you know. But for traditional wage earners, middle class, working class, wages aren't up. And even the wages that have been increased have been more than eaten up by inflation in areas, specific areas like rents and housing and medical and so forth, education and so forth, you know. Okay. Well, these targets, whether you talk about 2% inflation rate or unemployment rate or whatever, these are all just justifications for public consumption. They're obfuscations of the real goal, which is to continue subsidizing the private banking system by trillions of dollars because it cannot survive without slipping into another 2008-9, without this massive money printing and injection of liquidity and money into it. It can't survive anymore on its own. The state has to find new ways to prop it up. And that's what's happening since 2008 in particular, right? 2008-9 was kind of a threshold in the evolution of the global capitalist system, I believe, and particularly the banking system. A new stage has been reached where they not only simply bail out the banks whenever there's a crisis. It's a perpetual bailout, constant bailout. Oh, well, you know, why are they raising interest rates? Well, if they're going to raise interest rates, that's not a bailout, is it? It's just the opposite. Well, it's a contradiction because even though they need, central banks need, on the one hand, to provide this constant liquidity in trillions of dollars to its capitalist banking system, at the same time, the central banks say, geez, we need to prepare for the next crisis. We need to get some of this off of our balance sheet in order to be able to put even more on the balance sheet next time. So the central banks are facing a major contradiction. Right? On the one hand, they got to continue subsidizing the system. On the other hand, they got to prepare for the next crisis because they already have transferred trillions from the private sector debt onto their own debt. So they have a six of one, half dozen of the other contradiction, you see. They're trying to do both, balance both. And the contradiction, however, is also expressed, I call it the great contradiction, by the fact that pumping money into the private banking system to keep it afloat on a constant tens of trillions of dollar basis of 2008 injects massive liquidity into the system that then, because there's so much of it, gets loaned out by private banks and investors, a lot of it to speculate and invest in financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, foreign exchange derivatives, and so forth, right? In other words, it raises all this liquidity to keep the system afloat, raises debt leveraging, which leads to financial speculation and bubbles, and when the bubbles crash, brings down the real economy anyway. So the solution to keeping the system afloat creates subsequent crises in the system. And that's what my book is about, you see. The main themes of the book are central banks. First theme, central banks of the advanced economies, despite having been assigned by their respective economic and political elites the role of primary economic policy institution, have failed since 2008 to achieve their major objectives of long-run stabilization of their banking systems or the restoration of pre-2008 economic growth rates. You see, that's the mission of the central banks. Price stability, financial institution stability, and restoring economic growth rates. Well, look at the record since 2008. They've failed on all those definitions, haven't they? The banking system is still very fragile. They haven't, you know, over $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans. They haven't stabilized that system. You can see the eruptions occurring and everywhere around the world still because it's a global banking system. Have they restored price stability? No, they haven't restored 2% price stability. And on financial asset prices, it's been a bubble. So real goods and services prices haven't been stabilized at 2%, and financial asset prices have, you know, double-digit, triple-digit in some cases. So no price stability there, no banking stability there, and no pre-2008 economic growth restoration. Well, isn't that a failure? I would say so. All right, what's the second theme of the book? Quote, the decades of central bank liquidity injections since the 1970s, because that's when it begins, that produced the 2008-9 crisis in the first place, became the central bank's solution to that crisis in 2008-9. That same liquidity solution since 2009 has become the cause of the next crisis, as tens of trillions of dollars of even more liquidity-enabled debt has since 2008 been piled on the original trillions before 2008. Here's an ominous statistic for you, comment on that. Private corporate business debt as a percent of U.S. GDP is now at 45% of GDP. GDP, of course, is somewhere between $19 and $20 trillion in the U.S., you know, so 45% of that is private corporate business debt. Now, 2007, it was had risen to 45%. In 2000, before the crash, the tech bust crash, it rose to 45%. We're at a level of private corporate debt as a percent of GDP that is exactly the same today that it was on the eve of the 2001 tech bust and recession and the 2007 housing bust and credit derivatives bust and the great recession that followed. We're right there, 45%. Well, that's an ominous indicator. Okay, that's the second theme. Third theme here. Central bank's function of lender of last resort, in the past designed to provide excess liquidity in instances of banking crises, has in the 21st century been transformed into a new function. The subsidization of the private banking system by means of constant central bank excess liquidity injections. The private banking system, capitalist banking system today, has become addicted to and increasingly dependent upon significant continuing infusions of liquidity by central banks. You know, they talk about the opioid epidemic in the U.S. Well, the private banks have been sniffing this stuff for 9 years now. They're addicted to it. Free money. They don't earn it anymore. They get it for free from the central banks. This is a major transformation that's occurred in the banking systems and capitalism since 2008-09. Theme four. Central banks have failed to evolve apace with the rapid transformations of the global private capitalist banking system. Structural change in the global financial system, the continuing fragility of banking systems, and the excess levels of debt and leveraging mean that interest rates post-2016, i.e. today, cannot be raised very much. And central banks' balance sheets cannot be reduced to any significant extent without provoking a widespread credit crisis throughout the private banking system. Think about that one for a minute. Central banks can't, the Fed can't raise prices very high, cannot sell off its balance sheet very much without precipitating a credit crisis and the collapse of these financial asset bubbles and stocks and so forth that will then spill over to the real economy that's already fragile, not growing very much at lowest historical rates, and drive that real economy into a deep, even deeper recession than it did in 2008. Very important. How much can the Fed raise rates and sell off its balance sheet? Well, we don't know for sure. I would guesstimate that the benchmark federal funds rate, you know, which is at 1.25, cannot be raised beyond 2%. Maybe not even that, without precipitating these financial asset bubble price collapses. Another indicator, the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond, which is at 2.4 or something like that now, probably cannot be raised beyond 3%. Okay, these two key indicators, federal funds rate and the 10-year bond rate. Right? They can raise it some more, but not much. Any economist terms, what this means is that the elasticity of interest rates with regard to real investment, the real economy, GDP, has become increasingly inelastic to the upside, just as it was inelastic to the downside. In other words, from 2008 to 17, they dropped interest rates from the 5 or 6% federal funds rate. In other words, at the time the crisis erupted in 2008, they dropped it down to zero. And in Europe and Japan, negative. And they got the weakest recovery in history in the U.S. and stagnation and multiple recessions in Japan and Europe. Despite this, trillions and trillions of dollars driving interest rates to zero and below, they could not get real investment that creates real jobs and real recovery going again. Even in China, you know, in 2010, for every dollar of liquidity injection by the People's Bank of China, the central bank, they generated a dollar of real GDP investment and growth. But by 2016, it took $4 of liquidity money injection by the central bank to generate $1 of real growth. Even in China, you see, same problem. As China opened itself to the rest of the global financial economy, right, it started experiencing the same problems. And China, of course, has had a policy of fiscal stimulus from the very beginning in 2009 and 10, unlike the rest of the advanced economies, which have been fiscal austerity, degrees of fiscal austerity. You see, when you turn economic policy over to the central bank as the primary institution, which is controlled ultimately by the private banks, when you do that, you're going to de-emphasize fiscal spending by the government. In other words, the central bank has become the primary policy instrument. Monetary policy has become the primary instrument in this post-2008 period. Well, that's because the banks control it. And in the book, I describe how the banks control it. It's a very clever way. It's not as direct as it was when the Federal Reserve was first created in 1913. The bankers staffed everything. All the federal districts were all bankers, you see. All of them were bankers, run by the bankers. Well, when the Fed screwed up in the 20s and early 30s, couldn't even bail out its banks, the government stepped in under FDR, and there were some reforms, and left the bankers, but only 6 of the 9 committee members in the district were bankers, and the other 3 were supposed to be community assigned people in the federal districts, you know. But the banks still controlled 6 of the 9, and they still appoint their banker president of the district Fed. Well, I talked about all this last week, and it's in the book. I'm not going to go over it again. But there are ways, more indirect, that the banks run the districts, especially the New York Fed, which is key district, and even the governors that are supposed to be additional appointees by the government, you know, are really safe appointees vetted by the banks through the whole process of appointment and revolving doors and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the banks still run the show. And if you're going to give the banks control of the primary policy instrument, you're going, the bankers are going to say, no, no, we don't want government spending. Right. We just want to do it through the central bank with free money. See, if you do it through government spending, have fiscal spending to stimulate the economy, well, then the bankers and capitalists only get wealthy to the extent that people, average wage earners and so forth, middle class, working class, whatever, get more money and more income. And as a result of more money and more income, they are able to spend more on goods and services, and you make more things and you sell more things, and by selling more things, companies get their profits and so forth. So it's kind of a bottoms-up approach. Fiscal policy is a bottoms-up stimulus approach. But what we've got with monetary policy, central banks running the show, it's a top-down. It's a top-down approach. And that's why the banks love it this way. Give us free money, and we'll trickle some of it down. Maybe. Through real investment. Well, it's more like a drip-drip. It's not much of a trickle. You know, fiscal spending is trickle-up. Right? What we got now is drip-drip down. Very little. And they like it that way, you see. Central banks are their key instrument for keeping this free trillions and tens of trillions of dollars free money flowing, subsidizing them. Fiscal austerity is the flip side alternative to maintain this monetary policy approach. So when you hear economists like Paul Krugman railing against, oh, why aren't they spending? I can't understand why they're not engaging in fiscal spending. They know why. They don't want to do it that way. It's not as profitable. More profitable for the central bank to print free money. That's what's profitable. Okay. Well, that's what the book is about, too. Okay. Well, I talked about four themes, right? There's a fifth theme here in the book, right? And that is central banks must undergo fundamental restructuring and change. That structure, restructuring, must include the democratization of decision-making and a redirecting of central banks toward a greater direct service in the public interest. Okay, at the end of my book, I talk about this in some detail. And what I propose is a constitutional amendment to elect directors to the central bank by four districts in the country. Elect so that they are accountable to the public interest. Well, that's a pretty radical proposal. Well, I also indicate in the book that they have to be democratically accountable. In other words, they can be recalled, just like anyone else elected to Congress or local government or so forth. They could be recalled if they aren't doing their job in the public interest. And that the target should not be price stability of 2%. The target should be disposable income of households. You know, are they undertaking policies that promote disposable income or not? That's the target. And they should be transformed. Central banks should be transformed in terms of their functions into a national public banking system. Public banking. That was not-for-profit public banking, of which there are some in some states. Well, the Fed should undertake that function in order to carry out its public interest mandate. And it should also undertake a function as a public investment corporation during crises. In other words, you don't restore stability by putting money in the banks. You store stability by spending on fiscal investment. Anyway, the last chapter is about the amendment and the 20-article enabling legislation provisions on how to implement making central banks more responsible to the public interest. You see, I don't agree with libertarians that, oh, you got to get rid of the Fed. You know, Ron Paul, End the Fed, his book. That's not going to change anything. You're just going to let the banks carry out their control through the U.S. Treasury. What do you want to do? You want to get rid of Janet Yellen, the central bank, abolish it, and put it in the hands of Steve Mnuchin from Goldman Sachs who runs the Treasury? Is that the solution? No, that's not the solution. All you're doing is trading one pro-banking institution or department for another. You have to have a central bank of some sort. The question is, who is it, to whom is it accountable? That's the question. Is it accountable to the public interest, to the people, or is it accountable to the bankers, you see? Before there were central, the Federal Reserve and the central bank, you know, they were always had a treasury, and the bankers always ran the treasury in this country. And the treasury failed miserably in the 19th century to carry out the function of banking supervision and currency money supply management and control. It failed terribly. Turning it back to treasury isn't going to change anything. No, no. What we have to do is democratize the Fed. That's what we need to do. And yes, it's pretty radical, constitutional amendment, make these four directors instead of 19, break the power, elected, and break the power of these federal district Fed presidents who are selected by the bankers, the six or seven bankers. I mean, look at the nine-person committee today on the New York Fed. Three bankers, three banker-selected businessmen from the non-bank sector, but from companies that are dependent upon the banks. And then you got the three public, so-called public representatives on the bank, but the chair, the seventh person, has to have, according to the rules, significant banking experience. So that person's not going to be a true community person. They're going to be a banker that happens to be running a nonprofit or something like that. So New York Fed, seven for sure out of the nine are bankers. And it's the same story everywhere else in the other 12 districts. It's a formalist kind of a facade for banker control. And then, as I said last week, what about these seven director governors that are appointed by the president? Well, look at those. They're supposed to be appointed 14-year terms. Their average term in office is 3 years. And then they go off and work for the banks or some financial institution or end up on the boards or whatever. Yeah, there's four of them. Four of those seven positions aren't filled right now. And Trump's going to fill them, and you know who he's going to fill them with, right? He's going to get rid of Janet Yellen. And what happens with these chairs of the Fed? What happens with them? Well, it's revolving doors for them too, you see. What's Ben Bernanke doing? Oh, he's giving $200,000 speeches to bankers and financial groups and businesses. $200,000 a crack. Oh, and he's sitting on boards of shadow banks like Citadel, private equity firms, so forth. Alan Greenspan, same thing. Revolving doors, right? If you know you're going to, after your term, if you perform well in the interest of the banks, you're going to get a nice fat sinecure. You know, you're going to sell a book and make a couple million. You know, you're going to sit on the boards of some corporations and finance and banks, you know, and get paid $500,000 for each one each year for three or four meetings a year. Or you're going to get invited to all their trade groups and so forth and give these speeches at a crack of $200,000 or more. Do you think you're going to be hard on the banks? No. You know where your bread's going to be buttered. You see, that's how we do it in the U.S. We aren't overtly, immediately corrupt. We are ultimately corrupt. It's not like some banana republic, you know, where the guy's got his hands in the public purse from the get-go. No, 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 no. We reward them after they've proven that they've produced for us capitalists and us bankers. Then we reward them nicely. And the guys who come after it, they know. They know the process. They know how it works. They know, like Ben knows, I was just an academic. Okay, Princeton University. I know because I've seen it with others before me. If I do well and help the banks out, you know, I can enter the ranks of the capitalists. I'll get millions. That's how it works in the U.S., you see. Well, the U.S. and global economy are weak and fragile, and if they raise interest rates too much, either directly or by balance sheet sell-off, they're going to precipitate a financial market contraction of major proportions that could really get out of hand. Well, what are the weak points in the U.S. economy? How is the U.S. economy so weak? Well, look at autos, really in retreat now. Retail sales, same thing, same problem. And if they repeal the Affordable Care Act, which they're going to do, right, all that spending on premiums, insurance premiums, and all that spending on health care, now that tens of millions have it, is going to go away. So you're going to have a decline in health care spending of major proportions, auto spending, retail sales. Consumption is going to slow even further. It's not so great right now. What about investment? Well, look at bank lending. In the last 3 years, bank lending, you know, construction and infrastructure, C&I loans to small, medium businesses has collapsed to zero. There's no bank lending growth going on to small, medium businesses. Look at all the news about 10 to 20 state budgets in crises. Now they're admitting there's not going to be any infrastructure spending this year. And they'll pass a corporate tax cut, but corporate tax cuts have very little effect on real investment and real spending. Another indicator is federal tax revenues, which are down sharply now. That's an indication of what's going on in the real economy. And they're admitting there's not going to be any Trump bump. We're back to where we were, in a weaker economy than even in the last years of Obama. And there's going to be waves of layoffs coming, I predict, in auto, retail, and the tech sector. Other indicators are home prices have peaked. They're at where they were in 2007. And this thing called the yield curve, the economists and businesses look at, has narrowed to pre-recession red light levels. That's between short-term and long-term rates have narrowed. That's always an indication and predictor of a recession coming. Right? We're in the ninth year of the poorest, most anemic recovery ever. And we have bubbles in financial asset markets, and the Federal Reserve is starting to raise rates and sell off its balance sheet, which will do the same. And as I predict, that cannot go very high, because the elasticity is very inelastic here, as economists like to say. It's going to provoke. Raising the rates just a little more is going to provoke a retraction of financial asset prices and the real economy, which is already very weak and fragile. That's what's going to happen. At least that's my prediction. Based upon what I have indicated in my book. Okay, well, that's the end of the show today. And next week, we will be looking at events of the week, which I'm sure are going to be very interesting here. And if people are interested in some early information on my book, Central Bankers at the End of Ropes, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, which will take you to the publisher and more information.